This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association. A half-hour program featuring interviews and commentaries relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. I'm your host, Jay Schell. We're talking today with George Werthner, professional photographer, writer, and ecologist. George has written more than 24 books on natural history and other environmental topics. He's currently the Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. So George, welcome. We're glad to have you back. We want to talk today about the wilderness potential in Montana, in particular on the Gallatin-Custer National Forest, and why wilderness designation is so critical.
Yeah, that'd be great. So the Custer and Gallatin Forest is one of the premier wildland ecosystems as part of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, which is the largest intact temperate ecosystem left in probably the world, but certainly in the United States.
Yeah.
And so we have both a responsibility and obligation, in my view, to try to perpetuate that ecosystem and its attributes into the future. And the number one attribute of that is its wildness and its wildlife. And those attributes are protected best through the Wilderness Act, which is the gold standard for conservation. There are other ways you can reduce impacts to the landscape, but they're not as firm, as well legal tested, so to speak, tested legally, and as effective as anything else that we have out there. So wilderness, as a result of the 1964 Wilderness Act, is our prime method to protect these lands in into the future and for future
generations. What prompted the Wilderness Act?
Well, it's a really interesting story. If you want to go back, I'll give you a little background on it. Originally, back in the 1920s, the Park Service was just getting established. It was established in 1916. We had some national parks like Yellowstone and Sequoia and Yosemite and others that were established prior to the Park Service being created. But the Park Service started working to establish new national parks. And most of those new national parks were being created out of national forest lands. And so the Forest Service was a little bit upset that some of its prime scenic lands were being, put under a different agency. So in reaction to that, a fellow named Aldo Leopold, who's well known to people that have read his books, Ann County Almanac and others, who was a ranger and in the Southwest, proposed to the Forest Service that they, one way to counter this trend was to come up with their own standard for protecting their best lands. Mm-hmm. And so he proposed that the Gila area, what is now the Gila Wilderness, be set aside as at the time it was called the Gila Primitive Area. Mm-hmm. And that set in motion a tendency or a trend with the Forest Service to designate these primitive areas all over the West, which was increased in the 1930s by another guy who's well known in Montana named Bob Marshall. And Bob Marshall became the head of recreation for the Forest Service. And he came up with a plan to set aside, he called them wilderness areas and wild areas, but the Forest Service designated them primitive areas on some of their best lands around the West. So for example, what is now the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness was two components, the Absaroka Primitive Area and the Beartooth Primitive Area. The Sawtooth Wilderness in Idaho was the Sawtooth Primitive Area and so forth. And so these movers and shakers within the Forest Service actually and other federal agencies, including Olus Murie, who was a very famous biologist with the U.S. Biological Survey, formed the Wilderness Society back in the 1930s. And their goal was to get legal protection for these lands. And so they formed the Wilderness Society and hired a guy named Howard Zanuck to write up legislation, which was introduced into Congress 66 times. And finally passed in 1964. Mm-hmm. And many of these primitive areas that were Forest Service primitive areas were immediately designated as wilderness. Not all of them, though, so we had the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness didn't get created until 1978. but a lot of the Sawtooth Wilderness and some of the others were immediately designated as wilderness. And so that's how we started. And since then, through citizen initiative in many cases, new areas have been added to the wilderness system, half of which is in Alaska now. So you have, you know, huge wilderness areas in Alaska, like the Gates of the Arctic Wilderness and the Gates of the Arctic National Park is 8 million acres. But in the lower 48 states, our largest wilderness areas are in Death Valley, River No Return in Idaho, Selway, Bitterroot Wilderness, Bob Marshall Wilderness, Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness. These are the ones that are close to 1 million acres or larger. And a lot of times, there's an interesting thing, they get designated at different times, so you can sometimes get wilderness areas with different names, but they're essentially the same roadless areas. So for example, the largest area in the lower 48 states without a road that's protected as wilderness is actually in California, Sierra Nevada, but has different names. So you have the John Muir Wilderness, the Ansel Adams Wilderness, etc. But they're contiguous to each other. There's nothing separating them other than the name. So that's how it got started. And so we've been working on that in various states to try to increase the amount of wilderness, including here in Montana, for a long time. And various places have been nominated and added on. And one of the interesting things was one of the first citizen initiatives for new wilderness actually came in Montana too, with the Lincoln Scapegoat Wilderness. And that was a reaction to a proposal to log and build roads through that area. And Cecil Garland, who owned a store in Lincoln at the time, and some other people, but particularly he, got upset and started lobbying to try to get that added on to the Bob Marshall Wilderness and to protect it. And that was one of the first things that had ever been done by citizen initiative. So, and that started a trend where then other areas were then added on, the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness being a good one, or the Lee Metcalf Wilderness here outside of Bozeman and another.
So is there a specific definition of what wilderness is today?
Yeah, I mean, there are legal definitions under the Wilderness Act. These are the general, and there's exceptions to all these, but generally they have to be an area without permanent roads or, you know, housing or any other kind of permanent structures. But you'll find, you know, there's sometimes a Forest Service cabin or something that's an exception. They generally have to be over 5,000 acres in size. But again, there are wilderness areas that are smaller than that because it might be an island and that's as big as it is, you know, 1,000 acres or whatever. Or it's added onto an existing wilderness. It usually has to be trending towards influenced by natural processes. So, for example, a lot of the wilderness areas in the eastern United States were formerly forest lands or farmlands, but like for example, the Green Mountain National Forest, I'll give you, or New Hampshire, some of the wilderness areas there. But a lot of that area was farmed and logged back a century ago. And then the land was sold to the federal government. That's how almost all the national forests in the East were created, by purchase. And then they've been reverting back to more wild conditions, so they qualify as wilderness.
Oh, really?
So you can have pre-existing, you know, roads and structures and stuff, so long as they're, the cabins have fallen apart and the road is all washed out and that kind of thing. And the other thing that usually has to be a criteria for wilderness designation is that it have a chance for solitude, they say. You know, it's not a prerequisite. Obviously, some trails get a lot of people, but that's sort of another thing that you look for. And opportunities for, unconfined experience. The one thing that critics of the Wilderness Act use that's inconsistent is they say, there's some out there, mostly academics, that say there's nothing that's really wild in North America because, you know, Indians and Eskimos were everywhere before there were white people, and then the trappers were all over, etc. But that's not a criteria. The Wilderness Act specifically says untrammeled, and untrammeled means unconfined and basically self-willed. So you can have a place, like I said, you know, where there may have been a city there before during the gold rush or something like that. that was abandoned. And then, but so it's now basically on Trammell, so it would qualify under the Wilderness Act.
So there could be an abandoned road in an area that is currently designated or a candidate to be wilderness.
Exactly. A lot of, and there are other exceptions, like there are airstrips in the River of No Return Wilderness and in the Bob Marshall Wilderness, and all over Alaska airstrips in designated wilderness.
Yeah.
But those are pre-existing and they're grandfathered in. So.
Yeah, I did a trip on the Middle Fork of the Salmon a number of years ago, and we flew into one of those airstrips up there on the Middle Fork. Yeah.
Right.
When the first Europeans arrived on American shores, most of America was wilderness. So what happened in the intervening centuries to either encourage wilderness or see it abandoned?
Well, we had manifest destiny. And you know, there's an interesting story on a side to tell about that. And, you know, the whole goal of the American government for many years was to promote settlement and development of the American continent, including the American West. So we had things, particularly after the Civil War, things like the Homestead Act, the Timber and Stone Act, the railroad giveaways and so forth. All this, the Mining Law of 1872, they were all designed to try to get settlement, particularly in the West. And this is where Yellowstone comes in my view, because it was in the midst of this whole manifest destiny where the goal was to get every last acre that you could under some sort of human control and use. Congress decided to set aside this area here, saying, well, we're just going to set aside it for geology and nature, not develop it. So that was a big shift in the way we thought about things. And it sort of started the early conservation movement. Then we had Yosemite in 1890 and the Forest Reserve Acts, the first national forest, they weren't called that, they were called Forest Reserves, was the Yellowstone Forest Reserve on the east boundary of Yellowstone in the 1890s. And that started this whole idea of taking lands that were set aside and retaining them in public ownership, and in many cases protecting them from some development.
So where do we still have wilderness and what's left?
Well, you know, most of what is wilderness is, you might say, for better or worse, of the lands that nobody wanted. It was the stuff that nobody could figure out how to homestead or log or mine or otherwise develop. And so that tends to be higher elevation, steep terrain, topography, and so forth. And the vast majority of our wilderness areas tend to be, you know, characterized by those features. Here in Montana, some of the best remaining wildlands, like I started at the beginning, are on the Gallatin Forest. So the big one is the Gallatin Range, just south of Bozeman. And the area is, depending upon where you draw the boundaries, anywhere from 230 to 250 million, 250,000 acres in size, which is a sizable chunk of land. And the most important part of that whole Gallatin complex is the porcupine buffalo horn area, which has been identified forever as some of the best wildlife habitat in the whole ecosystem. And so hopefully, if we get around to protecting the Gallatin Range, that'll include the buffalo horn porcupine as wilderness for that reason, because that would be the best way to ensure that those biological attributes are preserved into the future.
There have been people pushing for wilderness designation of that area for many years.
Exactly.
Why has it not happened?
Well, you know, that's a political question. But the thing, the motion has been set. For example, as you're probably aware, a lot of that area had railroad sections in it. So the first step was to get rid of the railroad sections, which were traded out for lands around Big Sky. So that, you know, put more of it in federal, and there's some state land mixed in there. But at least it's all public land now, as opposed to sections of private land. And then the original proposal for the Lee Metcalf Wilderness, some of the proposal was actually to include the Gallatin Range and the Madison together. And because of the politics of the time, the Gallatin Range was subtracted out. So that was another effort to try to get it as wilderness. Mm-hmm. And now there's talk about trying to have just a single bill, legislation, that would try to protect the area. And part of it, not this whole 240,000 acres, but part of it is was designated a wilderness study area by the Senate Bill 293, which was passed in, I think it was 1977. And that bill set aside 10 areas in Montana that were officially protected as wilderness until Congress could designate them one way or another. And so a good portion of the Gallatin Range is part of that wilderness study area designation. And we've just been waiting around for the right politics to do something about it.
And what is the resistance? Where's it coming from?
Well, right now you have resistance from some of the politicians in Montana.
Who are responding to whom?
Well, let me finish what they're doing, and then I'll say who they're responding to. But they're trying to eliminate wilderness study areas on some of these areas that were set aside in 1977, plus BLM wilderness study areas, of which I believe there's like 45 in the state of Montana, and it would be 700,000 or 800,000 acres of land. A significant amount of our wildlands would be unprotected. That doesn't mean it would every acre would be developed tomorrow, but it opens the door to potential development. And I think they're responding to development interests. And also there's a philosophical objection to wilderness from some quarters. You'll find people that just believe that any kind of government regulation is bad, and wilderness designation is more restrictive. And almost every conservation thing you do is more restrictive. That's what conservation's about. Conserving is to restrict your use, self-discipline. And that's one of the things that the Wilderness Act and wilderness designation does, is it features that we take self-discipline. But some people, respond to that negatively. So
from the perspective of the public interest, what is the case for converting these WSAs into permanent wilderness?
Well, as I mentioned, wilderness is the gold standard for conservation. And we have very little land protected across the country. In the lower 48 states, only 2.7% of the land area is protected as wilderness. And even in Montana, I think it's only like 3.5% or something like that is designated wilderness right now. So
does that include national parks?
There's no designated wilderness in either Glacier or Yellowstone. They're managed like that, but they're not designated. I'm talking about official designated wilderness.
Right.
Now, roadless areas in Montana, we have maybe, if you put it all together, we'd have, I think there's something like 5 or 6 million acres that's roadless that could qualify as wilderness, but it's not protected. And so if you add that into what we have, that would be roughly 10% of the state. And another factor that's very important to understand is how this is driving the economy of Montana today. There are far more jobs that rely on having protected lands, whether it's Yellowstone Park or wilderness or whatever, directly as well as indirectly, than the old industries like logging and so forth. It's really important, and this is a point I really want to make. A lot of people are starting businesses here, bringing their businesses here, or living here, using making money someplace else and spending it locally. And that's a hidden part of the economy. I remember back in the 1980s, there was a study done when I was over in Park County in Livingston, where I was living. And at the time, if you had asked people in Park County what drives the economy there, they would said ranching, farming, mining, and logging. And yet only 5% of the income came from all of those things combined. And transfer payments, which is everything from royalties on a movie to Social Security to money in the stock market, whatever, was 40% of the earned income at that time. And that was in the 80s. And I know it's just gotten bigger since then.
Right. one of the prime advocates of wilderness designation within Yellowstone along the Gallatin Range has been Howie Wilkie, a local guide and entrepreneur. And there has been controversy over whether that should be a designation within the park.
Yes.
Could you respond to that?
Yeah, I know that proposal. And the main criticism of it is that the Gallatin Range, the point is the Gallatin Range goes all the way from Bozeman down into Yellowstone.
Right.
The problem that critics have with Howie's proposal is that you're in Wyoming then for a lot of the southern end of the Gallatin Range. And therefore, politically, you complicate things because then you got to get Wyoming to agree to it too. Now, there is something to be said that a lot of times, you know, the politics of wilderness designation can be really serendipitous.
Yeah.
I can give you many stories of how things that were protected serendipitously, and you have to have your proposal out there. That's my point. Sitting out there, and then sometimes things happen in politics that you would never believe would happen. Just to give you one example of that, when the California Desert Wilderness Bill passed in 1994, it made over 8 million acres of wilderness. And the advocates of that bill basically went around all the BLM land they could find in the California desert that could possibly qualify, and they put it in their legislation. And they didn't compromise and say, well, you know, we better leave this out or leave that out. They put everything they possibly could in this big piece of legislation. And then there was a lot of controversy about whether to create a Mojave National Park that sort of took all the political pressure off of the wilderness areas. And so when that passed, they went every place that was in that bill passed that was proposed by conservationists. And one of the advocates who helped put that bill together, this is a little aside, he said, at that time, they drew the boundaries with magic markers on maps. And he said they found the widest magic marker they could find. And they had like a half a mile to the boundary to every wilderness area as a result. And you couldn't do that today because it would all be done with computers. But the point being is that who knows how the politics are going to be on things. And if they hadn't put that proposal out there, we'd probably have a lot less wilderness in the California desert today.
So how are wildlife benefited by having wilderness designation as opposed to WSAs or national forests?
BLM. Wilderness WSAs are almost as good as wilderness, except they don't have the legal protection, but they're supposed to be managed as if they are wilderness. But general national forest lands or BLM lands, of course, are open to all kinds of uses that compromise, at least for some wildlife, the benefits. So, you know, logging roads create a lot of access, you know, and elk and grizzly bears and everything else are definitely shown to react to that kind of human intrusion.
Stay away from them.
And that is lost habitat to them because they a lot of times permanently avoid those areas for sometimes several miles on either side of a logging road, for example, if it gets a lot of use. And then, you know, as we mentioned earlier, sedimentation from logging roads is a chronic source of sediment in streams. You have things like diseases can get introduced into wildlife that might not if there wasn't as much access. So there's a lot of you know, reasons why wilderness is, you know, benefits a lot of sensitive wildlife. And you know, just from, you know, since the Gallatin Wildlife Association, just hunting and fishing experience is better in wilderness areas. And it's a sanctuary for, I mean, they've done studies and shown that the best fisheries are in places that are roadless. You know, that's where the bull trout are surviving. That's where some of these other species that are endangered are surviving. And it's also the place where you know, elk and other wildlife, bighorn sheep and so forth do best. So even from a hunting point of view, you know, wilderness is a good thing for a lot of hunters. And that's why, you know, some of the other groups out there, backcountry hunters and anglers and others, are wilderness advocates.
So ORVs and bicycles Are they disturbances to wildlife in wilderness areas?
They are definitely
non-wilderness.
They are. There's lots of studies that show that there's two ways. One, if those activities occur, regularly, the wildlife avoids those areas to a greater distance. In other words, they avoid places even where there's hikers. But and I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. But let's say they avoid places with hikers by 500 feet, it might be 1,500 feet or 2,000 feet if it's motorized or mountain biking. The other thing is the speed of which you can travel shrinks everything. So if you're on a mountain bike, you can go, 10 miles in an hour. There aren't too many hikers that go that fast. And so it shrinks the whatever benefits happen because of roadlessness and remoteness are compromised by the mechanical advantages, like from bikes and from ATVs and so forth.
Good. Well, George, thank you very much. This has been very interesting. It's been great to interview you. We've been speaking with George Werthner, professional photographer, writer, and ecologist. You've been listening to Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association. I'm Jay Schell.